and stoplights on Main Street and a few other things. It's been a battle to make it for our speaker today, but we're terribly pleased he could drive up all the way from Chapel Hill for our meeting, and we're looking forward to the discussion. I first heard of Michael Lenish when I saw a list of distinguished political theorists that a particular department was examining for appointments, and his name was very high on that list. He is an authority on the Constitution and the constitutional tradition. He's a scholar on conservative thought. He was born in Clinton County, Illinois. He received his bachelor's degree from the University of Illinois and his master's and PhD from the University of California at Berkeley. He's a recipient of numerous awards, and I want to say something maybe he doesn't even know about one of them. These awards are the Peter N. Odegaard Award, the NEH Fellowship, the Earhart Foundation Fellowship, and the R.J. Reynolds Award. The one I want to mention is the Peter Odegaard Award. The only person I've known in my life who had more energy and more vision, more determination than Wilson Newman was Peter Odegaard. He used to give a course on American government that some of you may remember that was 6 o'clock in the morning. And this was an exciting experiment. It was one of the first television courses that was given. Peter Odegaard wrote a book on the politics of the Prohibition Amendment, and really plumbed to the depth of that movement and how it came about. And he believed in the movement. He happened to be a teetotaler and a prohibitionist, so far as I know. But the more important and the more personal thing is Peter Odegaard used to visit to interview faculty members, not in ones and twos, but in platoons and battalions. He'd bring in 8 or 10 people to teach during the summer, and all of them would get some kind of an offer or inquiry. This was in the house before you were born, probably. It was in the halcyon days of the 1950s, and he had this enormous energy and striking quality of a leader. Professor Lenish is also president of the North Carolina Political Science Association. He's the author of the book New Order of the Ages. He's written on In Defense of the Anti-Federalist, The Constitutional Tradition, and Interpreting Experience. His fields in which he researches and teaches are political thought, philosophy, and American government. We've had discussions on various movements. You recall that Strom Thurmond spoke on the conservative tradition and its five varieties. Senator McCarthy spoke on the liberal tradition, Eugene McCarthy. And others, including contributors to this book, Science, Religion, and the Humanities, contributed to discussions on one of the two subjects that you're never supposed to discuss if there's to be peace and harmony in a family. One is politics, and unfortunately that's our main responsibility here. But the other is supposedly religion and its connection with politics. So we're dealing with both taboos today, but we're doing it through the eyes and research of a leading scholar on the subject, and we hope this can be a lively and informative experience for all of us.
Professor Lenish.
Thank you. Thank you. Thompson, that's nice of you. It's kind of you. Thanks. It's nice to be here. Beautiful, blustery all morning. I want to talk about the religious right. Topic that I studied on and off for about 10 years now. Can you hear me? Are you out there listening to me?
Yeah, there's, we've got something taped in.
I know it's a tradition to begin talks at Charlottesville with a reference to a local sage who presides in spirit from a nearby mountaintop and inspires our politics in a lot of ways, I think. Even today, I'm inclined to do that. I believe in tradition, and I do study the founding, and I'm a great admirer of Thomas Jefferson, but I'm going to be referring today not to him exactly, I'm not going to begin with him, but rather with another local notable, the Reverend Jerry Falwell, who presides, holds forth from another nearby mountaintop, Liberty Mountain in Lynchburg, and who has had, I think, an influence, a fairly significant influence on American politics, at least in the 1980s. Hello, Jeff.
How are you?
It's the New Christian Right that I'm talking about, that movement of preachers and politicians and their followers that combined conservative religion and conservative ideology, political ideology, into a very potent brew and became, as a result, I think, one of the most important of the new social movements of the 1980s. On the face of it, they seem to be gone. We haven't heard much about them lately. In fact, many of the signs would suggest that they have come and gone. As witness, for example, the sordid collapse of the PTL empire of Jim and Tammy Baker, or the fact that many of the television preachers in the wake of that have had a very difficult time over the past year or two. Jerry Falwell himself has had to put bills of some $65 million and has cut back on programming in at least 22 states. We have seen Oral Roberts forced to come down ignominiously out of his prayer tower, where he presumably was waiting to be transported somewhere up to reside at the right hand of God. And then, on top of that, adding insult and injury, to be called before a congressional investigating committee looking into fraud and financial abuses among televangelists. And then, too, finally, and most approximate, most political, was the failure of Pat Robertson to get more than really just a handful of votes in the 1988 Republican convention. All of that would suggest that this is a movement whose time has come and gone. I don't see it that way. I think that while admitting all of that, all that has gone on, I think we need to be careful not to dismiss this movement, which I believe has not so much disappeared as rather changed or been transformed, and which remains, I think, now and for the future, an important part, really a permanent part, of our politics, especially in what we've come to call the New South. And also, I think, this is a movement which, as a result, poses some problems for governing, which is the topic of this seminar series, and I want to say something about this. This is a little bit more spontaneous than usual, perhaps, because, look, as you can see from my notes, something was spilled on them, and there are big blobs here, so if I seem to be working harder than usual, it's because my notes are blobby. I want to go on, elaborate on this view. that the religious right has not disappeared, however heretical it may be. I want to begin by looking back to the fact that religion and politics have long, always, I think, gone hand in hand in America. We are a nation founded in large part by 17th century religious dissenters who sought to construct here in the New World a Christian commonwealth. We're a society that had state churches in many of the American states as late as 1819. A country where much of the reform impulse of the last three centuries has been the product of evangelical religion, as seen in part in influences that affected the American Revolution, abolitionism, women's suffrage, the civil rights movement, and others. Especially in the 20th century, ours is a politics where in which religion has had been particularly influential in shaping conservatism. With the coming of religious fundamentalism beginning around 1910 and the creation of the Christian anti-communist movements of various kinds from 1917 on. For example, Father Coughlin, the Reverend Carl McIntyre, the Reverend Billy James Hargis, some of whom you may remember. And in the 1980s, the Moral Majority and the Pat Robertson presidential campaign. So there's a long history to the involvement of religious, the connection between religious conservatism and political conservatism in America, and religion and politics more broadly. Moreover, this is a timely movement, I think. It's typical of our times. It's a timely movement religiously, the product of a recent but extremely important religious revival, what some have called the Third Great Awakening in America. Beginning in the decade of the 1970s, conservative churches began to grow in this country and grew by some 10 million members. I mean by conservative churches, which maintain a belief in the inerrancy of the Bible, in which conservative Christians believe in the inerrancy of the Bible, have experienced a born-again religious conversion, and have in their lifetime attempted to convert others. That's George Gallup's definition, three main elements, all of which are required to make conservative religion. Churches, those conservative churches, grew by 10 million members in the 1970s, while at the same time, mainline churches declined by 2 million members. This growth has started to level off a little bit, and the mainline churches have started to hold their own, but my sense is that it's an important and fairly long-term pattern. In 1984, a Gallup poll showed that 35 million Americans consider themselves religious conservatives, and another 20 million Americans were sympathetic to religious conservatism. It's interesting to me that this is a new kind of conservative religion. Traditionally, religious conservatives in America were either fundamentalists, sectarian, fairly closed believers in the literal truth of the Bible, or they were evangelicals, a very different kind of breed who went out into the world to bring in the good news of salvation, or they were Pentecostals, what all have also been called spirit-filled Christians, people who have experienced the immediate
deeply emotional, ecstatic experience of grace. What's important about conservative religion today is that while there are still divisions, theological divisions within this movement, the differences have tended to collapse over the last 20 years or so. And so it is that you can find someone like Pat Robertson, who grew up in the Southern Baptist Church, the Southern Baptist Convention, who is himself now an independent Baptist, who is a fundamentalist and believes in biblical inerrancy. He is also a classic evangelical Christian, one of America's leading evangelists, and he is probably the most important popularizer, at least, of a new style of Pentecostal, or what's now come to be called charismatic religion, the two most important indicators of which are glossolalia, the speaking in tongues, and faith healing. And Pat Robertson does both of those, speaks in tongues, and as you know, he also does faith healing. He has cured, he says, tumors, and he once took a scar off a man's face over the telephone, which is pretty impressive on two counts. And he has stopped a hurricane, I believe, wasn't that from hitting Virginia Beach, and so on. Well, the point is that the divisions have started to collapse. This is a new kind of conservative religion, and I think as a result, a more potent one. There are still tensions. There are definitely tensions, as we saw when Jerry Falwell went down, a fairly straight-laced fundamentalist, went down to become active or take over Pentecostal pleasure palace of the Bakers down at Heritage Village, and many charismatics were greatly angered by that. And so there are tensions there. You remember that strange picture of Jerry Falwell dressed in his black preacher's suit going down the water, 100-foot water slide at PTO, which it was anomalous at the very least. It suggests some of the tensions are still there. Nevertheless, the differences are collapsing, I think, into a much more a much broader constituency of conservative Christians. Add to this the TV preachers. Jeffrey Haddon is the expert on this. My understanding is that at least several of them, he'll correct me if I'm wrong on this, still bring in somewhere in the $1 million per week range in contributions. They are watched by, he will tell you how many people watch, realistically up to 10 million viewers, although they claim far more. These include large numbers of older viewers, large numbers of females, surprisingly large numbers of black viewers. Second, so this is a, the point is that this is a timely movement. It is a movement of our times. The second thing about this movement is that it is a contemporary movement socially as well, socially and economically. It is the product of the New South, having grown and flourished not in the Deep South, not in the Old South. It is not the product of old-time religion, but rather of the smaller cities, the rapidly growing, rapidly urbanizing cities of the Upper South, the Southern Rim. I picture the influence of the more or less equal influence of the television preachers and of political religious right as a kind of a great crescent. Jeffrey Haddon may have done this. I think I probably got this idea from him. I'm not sure. There's a great crescent. You can imagine in your mind beginning at Virginia Beach and then coming over here into Western Virginia at Lynchburg, and a kind of a wide path, reaching down throughout the Upper South, across the Upper South, to the Baker's Heritage Village in Charlotte, and then coming down into the Southwest, where, as Jeff Haddon has shown, more people in the, what is it, Monroe, Louisiana, El Dorado, Arkansas, viewing area watch Jerry Falwell than in the entire city of New York. That's not a percentage of the population. That's more people, and literally more people, numerically more people. And then reaching down into the new cities of the Southwest, into Dallas and Fort Worth, where James Robeson has been a very important figure, and then ending in what is in Southern California, which is traditionally an area of both conservative stronghold, of both conservative religion and conservative politics. That is where the religious right is found. That's where the new Christian right is found. That's where most of the television evangelist viewers are found as well. The point is that this is the Upper South, not the Old South. It's the New South, the South of today and of the future. Its followers, the followers of this movement, are members of the new middle class. Contrary to stereotype, they are not hillbillies in pickup trucks. They are middle class people. They are moderately well educated. They are moderately skilled, moderately well employed, moderately successful. They work in clerical and in service jobs. They are computer programmers. They are salespeople. They are moderately prosperous. Prosperous enough to want more, I think. Prosperous, only prosperous enough, I think, to worry. As I guess everybody these days does economically about the future. They shop at the malls. They dress fashionably, if modestly. They are the new middle class of the New South, part of the new middle class of the New South. To my mind, they are a transitional, or maybe better, a better term would be to say that they are liminal people. They are people who live on the line. Some of them are literally in transition, having moved from the small towns and the farms of the South into the new cities, where the jobs are and the education is. Often the churches, you will find, are physically located, sort of halfway between. If you want to find the local religious right, in town, you don't go to the center of the city, the center of town, where you will find the First Baptist Church, although that's sort of changed since the Southern Baptist Convention has become a fundamentalist one, becomes more complicated. But on the whole, you don't go to the center of town, you don't go to the old established churches, you go to the fringe, to the edge of town, where you will find these new style conservative churches, usually brick, rambling structures, often with a Christian school associated. They'll have names like the Open Bible Baptist Church. It won't be the First Baptist. It'll be the Open Bible Baptist Church, or the Providence Revival Temple, or whatever. These churches are a kind of a middle ground. They provide a transition place between the country and the city. They really point in the city. They point really in both ways. Their social role is to acclimate parishioners to the best ways of the city while protecting them from its evils, the evils of secular society. The Christian conservatives stand in the middle. They culturally, they stand on the line. They accept many mainstream values. They are, for example, good consumers. very important in our society. They are loyal supporters of the corporation. They are, in other words, very good employees, solid employees. They embrace important parts of our popular culture. The men watch football games. The women watch game shows, all that those imply. But at the same time, they're suspicious of much of secular culture, and they live in their own, they have created as a result their own fairly unique subculture as well. One that rejects many mainstream values, one that's created its own social norms, especially important are sexual norms, that is, about the role of men and the role of women, norms about child rearing, but also other areas as well. The subculture flourishes in other areas as well, including economics and money management, business and employee relations, leisure, as witness the extremely lucrative Christian rock music business these days, other areas of life. If you go into a conservative religious bookstore, you will find whole sections on health and diet, Christian diet books on grooming, books by Tammy Baker on cosmetics, which include books by Tammy Baker on cosmetics, believe it or not, books on dating for teenagers and so on, many different aspects of life. Anyway, these are not hillbillies and pickup trucks. They are modern men and women. In fact, they are, an even better term, I think, would be one that you hear more and more these days, which is postmodern people, which is to say they are people who bring together a whole set of very different, sometimes disparate, and self-contradictory values in new and unexpected ways. Most important about Christian conservatives is that they are adaptable. Far from anachronistic people, this is not a throwback to an earlier age. This movement points toward the future. It is a movement comfortable with technology, as witness Christian television. Also other technological innovations. Direct mail, for example, the television preachers. Whenever you go home today and look at all that junk mail you get stacked up, it comes out of your mailbox from every good cause there is. You can thank television preachers because they were the ones who invented it, and the politicians and the PACs and the interest groups picked up on it from them. Also, the computer. There are thinkers within Christian conservatism who claim that this movement, that the computer will transform Christian conservatism into a global movement. The idea and kind of a global village religious conservatives. The computer is very important in their thinking because. It is argued that with the computer, and for that matter with all the technology that surrounds us today, that conservative Christians can create their own world that they never have to leave. So you can watch Christian TV all day now, I guess, on the cable network day and night. With the computer, you can work at home and not be touched by the secular influences of the corporation or the workplace. Especially important is that women can work at home, and they can, you know, push a button and on the modem or whatever and shoot their computer readout into the office somewhere miles away, while they themselves stay home and rear the children. This is a self-perpetuating movement. It is a remarkably young movement, made up in very large numbers by young families, If you go to Christian conservative churches, you will find that they are loaded with kids. It's a movement that emphasizes education. At one time, a few years ago, there were 10,000 Christian academies in this country. I think those numbers have declined a little bit, but there are still a lot. Over 1 million students being educated in Christian conservative schools. And this is to say nothing of the what's coming to be an even more important movement in our time, which is the homeschool movement. As the Christian academies decline, the students do not return to the public school system. They go into home, they tend to go into homeschooling in very large numbers. We should also keep in mind that that educational institutions are important not just at the lowest level. As we've seen now in the case of the Southern Baptist Convention, 4 out of 5 of the Southern Baptist seminaries are now fundamentalist seminaries. This means that four out of five Southern Baptist ministers will in all likelihood be fundamentalists. Maybe they won't. Maybe they'll be sick of it, having gone through those seminaries, but probably not. Finally, politically, this is a movement that's more active than ever before. From 1950 to 1974, 10 independent political studies showed that evangelicals were the least active and involved politically of all religious groups. After 1976, every study that I know of has showed them to be the most active and involved politically of all religious groups. We seem to see fewer Christian conservatives in national politics, that's true. But when we look more closely, we see more and more in state politics, in legislatures, on state textbook selection committees. We see them prominently in the New South in the Republican Party at primary time. Even more, we find Christian conservatives today at the local level, in local politics, where they can be found on city councils, boards of education, local library boards, perhaps not in Charlottesville or in Chapel Hill, but in those moderate-sized, rapidly growing cities of the Upper South, in smaller towns and places like Rocky Mount, or Asheboro in North Carolina, or I would guess Roanoke, say, in Western Virginia. So, Christian conservatives are there. They are especially influential, I think, in politically in the setting of agendas, by which I mean sometimes their very presence, even though they may not be a majority, even maybe only one committed Christian conservative, one angry preacher, can have an enormous effect upon a local library board or a local city council. If only acting as a kind of implicit veto. Anyway, all of that, it seems to me, is fine. That Christian conservatives, like everybody else, have a right and a responsibility to be political and to act as citizens, and more power to them. But there is, I think, a problem here, and it is a problem that I think is important for the way we govern ourselves today. Because Christian conservatives, to my mind, I think, practice a new kind of politics. One that does not subscribe to what we've come to call, know as, the post-war liberal consensus. It's a politics that is no longer tied to established parties. Most Christian conservatives are Republicans, but they're not very good Republicans. They're not loyal Republicans. They tend to be renegade Republicans, as a matter of fact, or Democrats, if they're Democrats, who are less loyal to the party than to some of its principles. And they choose the principles. This is a politics, this movement is symbolic of a politics that is no longer based on pluralist patterns of bargaining and compromise. Christian conservative politics is issue-oriented, often single-issue-oriented. It is deeply morally committed. It's often moralistic. It's uncompromising. Maybe most troubling of all, Christian conservatives do not tend to be wedded to the idea of toleration. Committed and uncompromising, suspicious of the concept of rights, frequently unwilling to recognize the rights of others, they tend to see toleration as moral weakness. And in this they stand, I think, I'm afraid, as symbols of a new kind of politics. A politics, a post-war politics. A politics that we're coming to see more and more today. America, I think, today is not one society, but many societies. We are not one culture, but many competing cultures. The post-war consensus that held us together is disappearing, or it's gone. And I think as a result of that, the politics that we are going to see over the next generation is going to be a politics that is more committed, more volatile, and probably more noisy than any we've seen in a long time. So then that, of course, raises the issue of how do you govern, or how do we govern ourselves in that kind of politics? And I don't have any answers for that. But I do know somebody who was, who does, or did, and I want to end with him. This is a quote, after all, from Thomas Jefferson. His act for establishing religious freedom in Virginia, where he wrote that truth is great and will prevail if left to herself and has nothing to fear from conflict unless disarmed of her natural weapons, free argument and debate. So I'll end on that hopeful note, and it seems only appropriate, but I have questions.
Jeff Hayden has written widely on these subjects. I don't know whether you're currently chairman of sociology. You have been, but I suppose you're not now. But he has been chairman of the sociology department at UVA, and is recognized also in the religious field. Would you care to? We've got to concentrate our discussion so everybody gets a whack at this subject. But would you care to make brief comments?
Well, I would substantially agree with the analysis. I think the conclusion I would deviate from in some measure. While I think that the future is going to be noisy, I don't fear the presence of the Christian right in that process. I think if we learned anything from watching Jerry Falwell for 10 years, it is that he has at a very rapid pace become acculturated, understands the notion of getting a half a loaf today and coming back to fight tomorrow. And I think that sentiment is spreading fairly rapidly among Christian rights. So I see them as bringing focus to important issues in our culture, even though I find myself often do disagree with them. I'm glad they're raising the issues they are, and I see it as a healthy element in our culture, rather than as I think is generally perceived in America, that the fundamentalists are coming, look out and duck, because there goes the country and all that we've stood for. I think they represent an important element of renewal in many dimensions of our culture.
Another
either current or past chairman of another university department is Bill Miller, who's been chairman until recently of rhetoric and communication, and but writes widely in this field. Do you care to make comments?
Well, I know you want to get other questions in. I would just say two things. One, given that particular tie, I would heighten, wouldn't you, Mr. Leinisch, the role of the mass media, the electronic media, and especially television. This all would be a very different movement if you still had to travel about on horseback or travel by automobile or take yourself as a preacher to hither and yon, as is a great tradition of evangelical religion in this country. Now you've got a machine there. You can sit in Virginia Beach or Lynchburg or the other places you name, and you can come right into the home, bypass the structure. Well, that's a very big part of the thing. Of course, you would say that, but you didn't quite heighten it. It's almost to the point that it's a phenomenon of modern mass communications. That may be going too far for you, but I just put that to you to dispute.
No, I think it's true. Of course, the use of technology by conservative preachers is nothing new, at least in the 20th century. Billy Sunday, I guess, you know, brought the radio, brought the church through the radio into the home. I think television exacerbates it. It personalizes these. With television, we have a connection that's created between the viewer and the preacher that is highly personal. With that comes, I think, a kind of a social fracturing. The church is not there. You watch from the privacy of your own home. Remarkably, there are now Pentecostal preachers, usually local ones, who Ernest Lang Angley does this, a fairly well-known one, who will put his hand up on the camera in the studio, and then your job at home is to go up and put your hand on the television screen in your living room and be healed in that. You know, there's a presumably healing power that comes out of that. That seems to me to be a wonderful symbol of this movement and of our what's come of our age. There are many people who they're down on TV preachers. They're very highly suspicious of them and very critical of them for what they see as the manipulation of their audience. And there's no question that great amounts of manipulation does go on. Although I want to make it clear that they're all that TV preachers are maybe shouldn't be lumped together as in one group. Everyone is different. But the point that I wanted to make is that it seems to me that manipulation, quite aside, that the viewers are culpable in this as well. Now, maybe not all the viewers, maybe not the viewers who are shut in and can't get out to a church, whatever. But for a lot of viewers, TV preachers offer cheap religion. It's religion on the cheap. Sure, they send $5 or $10 every so often. But what they don't do, and what they don't have to do, is to commit themselves on a continuing basis, the way many people do, to a church community. And they don't have to be going out every Wednesday night to a board meeting or every Sunday morning to a church service. All they have to do is flip on the television. So they are have a certain responsibility in this too. It's in that sense, I think, often it's a kind of a self-perpetuating circle.
Colonel Foster?
Or did you touch on creationism and where is it going and what's its role?
That's a good question. I'm not an expert on creationism. And the best answer that I have is that I don't know. But my sense is that creationism has been a relatively small part of this movement. Christian conservatives the fundamentalism of Christian conservatism is a fundamentalism more often than not of biblical inerrancy rather than of biblical literalism. We use those terms interchangeably as synonyms, and they often do. Surprisingly often, Christian conservatives do not have a literal view of the Bible. There's a good deal of interpretation you'll find among Christian conservatives. So that a Christian conservative, you'll ask a Christian conservative, do you believe that the world was created in 7 days, the way a creationist does? Now, creationists will say yes. But large numbers of Christian conservatives will say, yes, I believe that because the Bible says it's true, which is the important point. But then if you ask them, well, what do you mean by a day? Or something, what exactly does that mean, having been created in 7 days? Well, then you will find a surprising amount of latitude on the part of most. Creationism, I think, tends to be a kind of a sub-movement within this movement. It is tends to be dominated by some extremely anomalously intellectual people. As you may know from studying it, it is a complicated, difficult, highly scientific business. My sense of creationism, I guess, in general, this is also my sense of the movement in general, is that it neither going to become a tremendously important part of our culture, nor is it going to disappear. There are 18th century, I've read plenty of 18th century sermons on creationism. I think it's different in that respect from another aspect of Christian conservative thought which is related, and that is apocalyptic thought. Sometimes they are related, especially through a kind of a larger notion of dispensationalism. So that many creationists also happen to believe that the world is going to end any day. That part of conservative Christianity I take to be in a lot of ways more interesting and less predictable, especially as we come to the end of the 20th century. I mean, the year 2000 is going to, in just a few years, I think we're going to see an enormous amount of apocalyptic end of the world thinking on the part of many people. And I think that, as a matter of fact, that this will be sparked even more by events in the Middle East. As you may know, apocalyptic theory is tied very closely in contemporary writing to Israel and events in Middle Eastern.
I just read last week that since the Middle East crisis, Helen's book is in.
Does the Mormon Church fit into this picture, or is that another story?
It's another story. The Mormon Church it's always been its own story and a fascinating story. But Mormons were in the early part of the 1980s did associate with the New Christian Right. I think it was always a somewhat tenuous association based mostly upon shared social values, the home, family type values, the role of women and so on. They found those that part of the social agenda to be congenial. On the other hand, Mormonism is historically, as you know, has some fairly strong sectarian, self-protective kind of qualities, and as a result, I think Mormonism has been less important to this movement than any of the other more traditionally Protestant branches of religious conservatism.
Thanks. Yeah.
Would you reflect on the quality of race relations within the religious right and the factor of racism in this regard? Do you see the powerful appeal of Mr. Duke in Louisiana as part of the religious right and the New South, or is that the Old South rising again?
Well, that's complicated, I'm sure that it's a little bit of both. It's important that the religious right is a product of integration. It came after the civil rights movement. In many ways, I think, styles itself. It has borrowed a lot of its politics, ironically, interestingly, from the civil rights movement. The new Christian right is adamant. It's adamant that it is not a racist movement. It is an overwhelmingly white movement, virtually entirely white movement politically. The picture is complicated because there are differences within the movement. Jerry Falwell, for example, if you watch the Old Time Gospel Hour on Sunday morning or whenever it comes on, you'll see him preaching from his pulpit at Thomas Road, and you will notice prominently right behind his shoulder, maybe here or here, there'll be a black choir member. Now, as it turns out, when they pan the audience, he's virtually the only black person in the place, but he's nicely stationed there, and it makes a kind of a symbolic statement that this is not a racist movement. Pat Robertson, somewhat in contrast, has very large numbers of black viewers. Very large minority of his viewers are black. On the other hand, politically, almost none supported him when they had a chance in Republican primaries in the South. So there is a difference there racially that the coalition tends to fracture when blacks are involved. I think that it's for a long time I thought that I took them at their word that this is not a racist movement. Socially, as far as social theory is concerned, the social thought of the movement is not racist. It's not racially inspired. Pentecostalism, I think, is even more extreme. I mentioned the difference between Falwell and Robertson. Someone was telling me recently that they'd been down to Heritage Village to Jim and Tammy's, to one of the big swimming pools down there, and it was totally integrated. It was about half of the people in there were white and about half were black. This was a black man who was telling me this. He said he'd never seen anything like that in the South before. He said it's really found it quite phenomenal. The social thought is race blind. By contrast, the economic thought is very heavily loaded on issues of race, so that when Christian conservatives begin to talk about the role of the state, welfare, etc., the language and the imagery is very heavily loaded racially. And as a result, I have become much more suspicious of the claims involvement that we're a totally integrated race, we're colorblind in this movement. As far as economic theory is concerned, this is not a colorblind movement. There is much talk about black people in the economic theory, about urban blacks in particular. It tends to be circumspect. Usually, frequently, again and again, the economic thinkers like to quote black economists. But the fact that it happens so often, I think, becomes in itself suspect. So, you know, I that's my sense of it. I think it's a fairly complicated.
Wilson Newman.
First, it seems to me that we are discussing a anthropological question as much as a religious or a political one. And I'm going to try to ask a question that takes out the geographical boundaries which you have suggested that this practice has surfaced itself. Fundamentalism, I guess, has been part of the human nature from Stonehenge to Heritage Village. Our society, as you've described, has grown up and developed under the philosophy of Thomas Jefferson, which you have quoted. There now looms in our lives a very important opportunity to observe and experience the development in another society, which certainly in recent decades has been governing itself ostensibly without the influence of religion, unless you consider the Communist Party a religion. To complicate the question, but to concentrate, I would ask you if Russia or the USSR is considering the creation of founding documents similar to our Constitution or to attend the same purpose. Based on our experience, would you think that in any way they should be different than what ours are?
Sorry, the punchline. I wasn't expecting that. you surprised me at the end.
That's a good question. I would guess that in a lot of ways they would probably be fairly similar. I'm thinking of the, there are important parallels. Our Constitution was founded in the wake of as a product of an anti-authoritarian rebellion, as theirs, not dissimilar, totally dissimilar to the one that's taking place throughout Eastern Europe now. Russia. I think that federalism is a very important concept for them, as it is for us. I think we can't underestimate our own the power of our own model in this. America has always been the first new nation, the first great revolutionary republic, and we have been emulated around the world now for 200 years. We have the oldest operating constitution of a free people in the world today, except for Iceland.
But I think we can't underestimate our example. So I would say that in many ways it'll be similar.
Next question. Yes, Howard.
I wanted to ask you, in your study, do you detect any interest on the part of the religious right in forming a third political party? Or do you think they're wise enough to believe that they have more influence actually by staying in the Republican Party and dominating it rather than trying to have a third party?
There has been, early on, I think, there was some talk of a third party. There's political precedent for that. 100 years or so ago, there was a kind of abortive or failed Christian party in politics in this country. My sense is that the more politic, the more sophisticated, especially among the leaders, Pat Robertson being typical, would see much more influence within the Republican Party, especially within the Republican primary, which is a setting in which Christian conservatives, especially in the South, given the fact that we haven't had a Republican Party in the South historically, and this is still a relatively small body as far as registration is concerned, that this still relatively small but highly committed number of Christian conservatives in that context can have an enormous amount of leverage. So I would expect Christian conservatives to stay within the Republican Party for that reason, kind of institutional reason alone. Also, third parties in this country, as you know, it's a very hard row to hoe institutionally, given the single member plurality nature of our politics.
Yes.
What effect do you think this movement has upon the religion in general in our country?
I think that it has revived religion in general in our country. It has made it has been especially important in invigorating liberal left-wing religion, ironically. Liberal Christians have been forced, I think, because of the religious right, to reiterate their liberalism, to reevaluate their theological views, to think more about biblical interpretation and what it means, but they've also been mobilized. And, you know, you will find, you have for a decade now, Christian liberals have been saying, wait a minute, you know, you can't the Christian conservatives have appropriated the label Christian. Well, I'm a Christian too, and a liberal. Or a radical, or whatever, however, you know, or a Christian moderate, whatever, however they're defined. I think it has been an important kind of revitalizing agent in that way. I think that's, I agree with Jeff.
It has hurt people like Dr. Shula and people in that.
It has hurt?
Hurt them.
Hurt them. In terms of viewers or?
Well, because it's a different type of preaching, and they only hear the one, they figure they're all the same.
Oh, I think that's probably true. I think that's probably true. I actually think that he was, I don't know what his, how he has done financially lately, but my sense of Robert Shuler is that intellectually, he was a little bit too close to this movement at the beginning, and then a little bit too slow to realize that he didn't want to become part of it. He did dissociate himself from it, but I think that he was very slow in doing that.
unlike Billy Graham, who made it clear from the start that he was, virtually from the start, that he was not associated with this movement. And I think that he has tended to benefit from dissociating himself from it.
We could go on a great deal longer. In opening up and developing, and we hope this can go on for years to come, the whole subject of governance, why we're caught in the midst of a controversy among political thinkers. One is that, as Lord Marlborough said, interests never lie. People do in politics what their interests drive them to do. Washington said the same thing. In the long history of mankind, there is only one universal, and that is that the guide to action are interests. Some have modified that and said, well, at the very least, if interests are the railroad track, why, the switch that moves you from one track to another are your ideas. Ideas are a switch that affect the way in which your interests are channeled. Some people who see politics only as ideas would say that, in fact, the track was ideas rather than this being the switch. So there's that controversy. But surely in the discussion of governance, we ought not to rule out what ideas, commitments, values mean, and people have their values that may not be the same as the values of others, and that's the justification. Someone said to me, well, what can the religious right in any way have to do with governance? I think we've heard this morning in this discussion of governance that it can have quite a bit to do with it. And nobody could have laid it out more clearly or more forcefully or more fairly than Mike Lenitz in his discussion this morning. We thank him very much.
Thank you.